Welcome to episode 6 of the Over the Counter podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck.
And I'm Andrew Whaley.
And today we have with us a very special guest, Mr. Christopher Check, who is the Director of Development at Catholic Answers. Welcome, Christopher.
Thank you for having me. Special, very special, may overstate it, but I'm honored to be here.
He is in town in Denver today giving a lecture on the Cristeros.
Right.
The Mexican Catholic Revolution?
Well, revolution's really more like reaction. I think would be better. In the late 1920s, after a period of about a decade of revolution and suppression of the Catholic Church, an armed landowning peasant uprising, largely in central western Mexico, emerged, and in the space of about 18 months, reclaimed large portions of Mexico for Christ the King and Holy Mother Church, and really knocked the Plutarco Calles administration government back on its heels, and may well have been successful had it not been for the intervention of the Coolidge administration, and then also some still complex and not completely unwound machinations involving the Holy See, the Mexican Episcopal Committee, and of course Dwight Morrow, who was representing the Coolidge administration. So, but the story of the men in the field is an inspiring one, and great martyrs and great warriors for Christ came out of that story.
And there was a movie that was just made about that.
Actually, right? For Greater Glory came out about 3 years ago, and I have to give props to the folks who made the picture. It's a complex story, and they got the sense of it in what's, I think, about 2.5-hour picture. They take some liberties with the history, mainly for the sake of narrative.
Sure.
Enrique Gorostieta never really meets the boy martyr there, José Sánchez del Río. One thing that the movie confronts fairly honestly and candidly is the American involvement in the war,
right,
and that the Americans were on what we would regard as the wrong side.
Yeah, well, I mean, just a contemporary situation that just reminds me of how complex these things can be is the Ukraine right now.
Sure.
Which is just marvelously complex. Nobody knows what's going on. And the United States doesn't seem to be really very effective in whatever we're trying to do. It's really unclear what we're trying to do.
Well, and frankly, my belief is it's unclear what we could possibly do.
Well, that's true, too.
Yeah. Great question whether it's our place to do much of anything.
Well, I would be with you on that point. And when you think about the fact that it was, you know, Nikita Khrushchev's pen that, you know, 60 years ago made the Ukraine no longer part of Russia, it's not really that long. And I think I don't know if I can say this on the my son Jean-Paul, he's 16 years old or 17, and he said he was in utero when he met the Holy Father.
Oh wow!
Yes.
So we named him Jean-Paul. But anyway, so
I was in St. Louis when I met the Holy Father.
We had the news on or something, and it shows that clip of Putin walking in, bursting through the double doors
right
into that big gold room, and John Paul says, "Putin's a badass."
How true it is, though.
Yeah. You know, he's just kind of cultivated that image. Yeah. Him out there shirtless and fishy.
On this big stallion,
And holding leopard babies or whatever.
Right, and then you've seen that one that's been circulated around the internet. I'm sure there's Putin on his big black stallion, and then there's Barack Obama riding his mountain bike with his bicycle helmet.
Mom jeans.
Yeah, exactly.
He's got the mom jeans and the helmet. I'm like, come on, man. Have a good. But he's a good basketball player. I'll give him that.
And he's getting slandered. You know, in the Soviet Union, they're saying, the former Soviet Union, Russia, that they have this anti-gay legislation or whatever. All Putin has said is, you're not going to teach gay propaganda to our children. I mean, that's what the law is.
Right.
And he's coming out against abortion. No more advertising of abortion.
Wow. Okay.
So what's to complain about?
I mean, there are issues. But anybody, obviously this goes through a lens of a bunch of preconceptions about ideologies and presuppositions about ideologies. And if you're going to say, no, you cannot teach our children about this, the homosexuality, you're obviously saying that there's something wrong with it, that it's not okay, that we don't – to not promote it is to basically burn people at the stake. And it's just
right. –
And that's a whole different podcast.
And another thing it calls to the center of our imagination, or should anyway, is that there are things deeper than what Americans like to call democracy or human rights or these sort of universal abstractions. There are things that are much deeper than these that run in the hearts of men and move them to action. So when the Cristeros went to war, they're fighting for the Mass, they're fighting for the Eucharist, they're fighting for Christ the King. Of course, Quas Primus had just come out a couple years before Pius XI's encyclical creating the Feast of Christ the King. But also in Russia, these things that run very deeply, as in the former Yugoslavia, ethnicity, religion, shared tradition, common songs, common language. And we tend to poo-poo those things in America and look at them with disdain. Oh, we're all the same. Well, we're not.
It kind of reminds me of modern-day China.
You said we're not the same.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of China, right? China supposedly is this one giant nation with one language, with one people, when really it's not at all, right? I mean, you've got all of these languages. You have all of these different cultures that are all sort of united, sort of, not even really,
under the Chinese flag. They all speak Mandarin, but it's kind of a lingua franca.
But they don't in Tibet. They don't speak Mandarin.
Well, I guess that's
true. No, I think there's like something like 85 different.
There are tons of languages and dialects and things. And those, like you said, are much richer and go back much further than whatever unity was imposed by the Maoist regime in the 40s.
Sure, or by the idea that came out of the head of John Locke or Adam Smith or Karl Marx, whoever it might be. But in America, it's almost taboo to speak in these terms because, of course, we had our conflict in the middle of the 19th century and in the war between the states, and that really people say, well, it was a war over slavery or war over freedom or war. It wasn't. It was a clash between two civilizations, a medieval one, a medieval Christian one, and a sort of modern industrial Unitarian one.
Yeah.
And those differences persist. Like you say, you go on a road trip today in America.
Yeah. Not kind of that being said. Okay. Obviously, states' rights and all the stuff and the different way of life in the South and everything. I'm kind of torn. I'm literally from 20 miles away from the Mason-Dixon line. I get grits for breakfast, but I'm on the Yankee side, right?
And do you put butter on your grits and pepper, or do you put sugar on them?
Oh, God forbid!
Andrew, what kind of coffee are we drinking?
We already had this coffee, but we don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
This is Finca Isnul from Novo. Spectacular, beautiful. Guatemala, Huehue Tenango, nutty, dark chocolate,
okay,
delicious.
But we've already talked about the grits.
Yeah, we always do the coffee as an afterthought.
I gotta start bringing grits.
So like, I was taught how to eat grits by two people from North Carolina, and they said the only thing you put on grits is enough butter that you can feel your heart stop, and enough salt to choke a horse. And that's it. And that's all I put on my grits. And it's just, like an ice cream scoop of butter and just like a ton of salt. Best thing on earth. Oh my gosh, it's so good. Now, I like the nouveau, kind of like cool nouveau southern stuff. Like, we went to Acorn inside this thing in the Source.
Wait, you were going to disagree with him about the Civil War.
Well, but first I want to say something in praise of the North, although I'm actually talking about the Midwest here. Did you know in Wisconsin it used to be illegal to sell margarine?
Because that's awesome.
Yeah.
Because of all the dairy farmers.
Right.
History has deemed them on the right side now that we recently realized trans fats are.
So what you did, if you lived in Wisconsin and you wanted margarine, God knows why anybody would, you had to come into Illinois and buy it. And of course, margarine in its natural color is white. Or natural, it's not natural. So they would put this little dye packet made out of carrots.
Yes.
And then you would massage the dye packet to make it look like butter.
Oh,
like,
God. Yeah. That's so disgusting.
Anyway, so there. Go
they
Wisconsin.
They healthy.
I think that we do have to acknowledge that there was this more medieval Christian civilization that kind of had a deeper connection to the land and an understanding.
Agrarian.
States' rights. More.
An understanding
of
seasons.
In a lot of ways... A more of a tie over to the culture of England, where we kind of all given. I will leave blood on the field for states' rights and all that, but they wanted to use people as hammers. They wanted to reduce human persons to tools.
Sure,
and so it's kind of six of one, half dozen of the other. I mean, you can't really go. Do we really want a giant economy on our border doing that. Now, obviously, I'm not gonna argue for the consistency of Lincoln across why the war was started and what he said and his statements on slavery and all. There's, I am a fan of Lincoln, but I'm not gonna say that the war was only about slavery. But I mean, slavery was a pretty big deal.
Well, I think use people as hammers is a generalization that doesn't give full expression to the history of slavery, or even necessarily right. the slavery that exists in the American South at the time.
I'll agree with you. When I'm playing devil's advocate on the other side of this argument, I bring those things up. My own forebears. Now, I had one batch of forebears that owned slaves, and they were one of those people that when the emancipation came along, every slave on their property chose to stay and make the exact same wages and live in the same conditions that they had before, because they treated them like employees. They treated them like good, like well-fed, well-paid employees. And it wasn't all Roots. It wasn't all like that.
No. And a lot of – well, we actually know Roots was fabricated and plagiarized, I think. But many of them received Christian baptism as a consequence of –
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but in any case, yeah, I'm not here to make the case for slavery. And when the South sent its ambassador to meet with Pius IX, Judah Benjamin or Judah P. Benjamin's representative they had several meetings with Pius IX. Pius IX made it clear, and he has a correspondence with Jefferson Davis. But he made it clear, we're not here to talk about slavery. I'm not going to. But
what was his argument? Come on, Aquinas, Aristotle, natural slave. I mean, come on, you can get in on this, can't you?
I think we could pull this podcast in his direction only. it's a nuanced institution. It's an abject human institution. What the church has always condemned, for example, is the slave trade.
Right.
Until this catechism, really, or the most, you know, there has not been so clear a statement that I know of.
Yeah. Because the catechism says something like it's contrary to human dignity or something like that.
Right.
So that's something very strong.
Well, there's also, there's a lot of different arrangements that get blanketly called slavery.
Sure.
Right, and so some of them are maybe
not like the MasterCard.
Oh God! Yeah. Well, think about this. Let's say that you're an indentured servant or something, but you entered into this freely. Then someone could argue, well, yeah, but you were, this bigger societal situation pushed you into the desperation to do that. How's that any different than a woman putting herself in porn or prostitution because she can't pay for her kids?
Well, certainly that is a kind of slavery.
I mean, So there are these kind of different quasi slaveries,
loans.
I'm definitely feeling that one.
Mortgages.
Sure.
Mortgages, yeah.
If anybody would like to donate to the Andrew Whaley Student Loan.
Over
the counter.
Most Americans are wage slaves.
No. I mean, no, that's definitely true.
So we've gone to many different places. Since we got to the Civil War, I wanted to mention two things that were worth mentioning. One was the Archbishop of New York was at one point sent by Lincoln and Seward, who was the Secretary of State, to go have an audience with Napoleon III to try to get French support for the North, because the North was terrified that the French were going to support the South because they wanted the cotton, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But just kind of a bizarre fact.
But you know, also, I mean, have you ever read Sheldon Van Auken's book, not A Grief Observed, that's C.S. Lewis, Severe Mercy?
No.
Well, it's spectacular. It's an actual memoir. It's a spiritual memoir, but it's one of the most tragic, beautiful love stories, too. And it's got a bunch of unpublished stuff from C.S. Lewis, because he went to Oxford and he corresponded with Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Sheldon Van Auken, A Severe Mercy. Run, don't walk, and buy it and read it.
Okay, I'm writing it down right now.
It's spectacular.
You're like the 50th person who's recommended this book.
It's a spectacular book. But that same guy wrote a second book that called Under the Mercy, and I think he ended up like getting involved with like the hippie movement or the beat movement or something like that. I can't remember. I didn't really read, but there's this little, he's a historian by trade, and there's a little essay in the back of that second book that he wrote as a historian. I guess it wasn't long enough, so they put it in there. And it's a fictional work of history talking about the history of the Civil War and how it went down and why the South won, because England entered the war on the side of the South. And what it says in the prologue to that little work is that, I guess they've found out since then by looking at documents or whatever, that there's an argument to be made that England was really...
Oh, sure, they were close.
They were super close to entering the war with the South. And what that would have looked like, and he builds the argument of why the culture in the South and how it fit so much more with the culture from England and how, you know, what you were talking about.
Yeah,
so
you know,
that's an interesting essay to read.
I just want to take exception with the expression "civil war" because that really that is a war
in the
parlance
of our time.
Okay, so, yeah. You're right, but a civil war is one that takes place within a state.
Yeah,
and at this time we still had sovereign states, so that's why I prefer war between the states. But people say that's clumsy. So, yeah.
Well,
but you're right. But we know.
But I think you know. Lest my
professor Richard Ferrier would listen to this podcast. He would.
I don't have to cover all your bases.
Well, no. I think that there's a decent argument to be made that these things weren't exactly states until they entered the Union, and it was the entering of that Union that kind of really codified them as states. And so they were only states in a federal system before.
Sure.
I mean, so that's it.
But they were sovereign.
Yeah. No, I'm with you there.
Yeah.
I mean, I often say that I'm a – people
okay,
say –
So one of the bigger picture trends here, though, that you pointed at the very beginning of our discussion about the war between the states is the
– You can say civil
war. Is the trend towards centralization away from decentralization.
Sure.
Right, which gets into those cultural elements that we were talking about, whether it be in China or the United States or wherever.
Right, and a religious element with the doctrine of subsidiarity.
Yeah, I was going
right.
to say, yeah.
And I mean, I don't understand it. From my own perspective, Americans seem very individualistic, and yet we seem to be really allergic to decentralization. We yep. like centralized systems, competitions, governments, militaries,
yeah.
all that. Why
I would venture to say that it is in fact that individualism that necessarily forces you into collective.
Yeah.
Because I would say this, there's really no such thing as an individual. I would talk about human persons.
Sure.
Right. But human persons, as we understand them, we understand human persons made in the image and likeness of God, of course, but in their interaction with other human persons. So in order to have a society, a man and a woman have to interact in marriage. That without marriage, you can't have a civilization or a society. So, so individualism, which is... you know, I think, therefore I am, that kind of
sure.
thing, the sort of the perpetual navel gazing, that detaches you from those natural and then sacramental human associations that start with a family, extended family community, by which we understand the doctrine of subsidiarity or through these. So I think that, you know, individuals are ripe for totalitarian takeover. That's
now. I mean, would you say that individualism has its roots in Protestantism, in Enlightenment?
I would say it certainly begins probably even before Protestantism in the Renaissance, but definitely finds its full expression in Enlightenment and then in the Revolution.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess I'm thinking of Protestant
the Protestant Rebellion is a step along that way.
Yeah. You know, like me and Jesus style religion. That
sure.
Kind of thing.
Sure. Sure. That's not Catholic.
Right. Right. It's not.
Yeah. Which is very much corporate worship, and corporate life.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
a reflection of the.
Corporate, I mean part of a body.
Right. And it's yeah. like, and that's a reflection of the deeper reality that it is a precursor and the source of all that. I've quoted this already once on the podcast, but I'll quote it again. I was at the Communion and Liberation New York encounter in New York, in New York, and a priest was talking about the Trinity, and he says, and he stops and he pauses and he looks and he says, "There is no alone.
Mm-hmm.
There never was an alone.
Yeah.
Alone doesn't exist. Alone is a lie."
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Well said.
And I'm like,
the Trinity.
Right.
Yeah.
Before there's anything, there's three.
Right.
The ground of being is community.
Right.
Right. Right.
And so the question is there a political order that more rightly represents that in this community where there are these persons, but they are defined, they exist as persons in this mutual giving of self, this dance of self-donative love, so to speak. That is there a way that gets writ large other than a sacramental way,
yeah,
in a societal way.
I think in American history there's a moment where, for all of his defects, you can find in Jefferson, particularly in his agrarian stuff, in Jefferson's thought on federalism, a political expression of this doctrine.
And and what's funny is I was listening to a Catholic documentary of some kind about the founding fathers, and did you know Jefferson? They found in Monticello. If you go there now, that's it.
I've been there.
Yeah.
He's got there's a dog-eared copy of St. Robert Bellarmine,
right?
And it's got pencil underlining marks in parts of Bellarmine that are those exact phrases show up in the Declaration and Constitution.
Wow.
So there was actually a quasi-Catholic or at least a classical Western natural law.
Oh, I think so, true.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch of Locke.
And there's a lot of Masonic mumbo jumbo.
There's a lot of Masonic mumbo jumbo mixed with a bunch of Locke and all that. But there's also the remnants. Men were still sane enough to kind of have the remnants of that great natural law tradition from Aristotle to.
Exactly. If America is something, it is a patrimony of European Christian Europe brought to these shores in 1492. Mm-hmm. And insofar as it's not that, then.
Okay, so I want to take this full circle now. So we've talked about individualism and community and America, but we haven't talked much about technology yet. And I think technology, especially in modern social media and all of this, is a great kind of, tipping point or whatever for us to kind of explore some of those dynamics. Meaning that things like Facebook or Google or whatever almost force, or cell phones, almost force you to be an individual rather than a member of a community. I mean, the best example of this is the phone in the home, right? So it used to be when the phone rang at home, anybody in the family would answer it and say, oh, this is a call for mom or for my brother.
Yeah, you called places. But, you didn't call people.
But now, right, every single person has their own phone number, their own email address, et cetera.
Right.
And people are more, isolated in their communication.
Well, sure. I mean, even in the 50s and 60s, people would gather around the television and watch whatever schlock was on. Now, now everybody's got his own iPad or whatever, and they're watching different things in the bedrooms. But I agree with you that modern communication technology has an isolating effect. I am skeptical about expressions about online communities. Mm-hmm. I think that would go to the question of what community is.
I think that if you want to push a solid either or, like, okay, here's this community that we've had up to this point, now here's the new digital community, and one versus the other, but that's not how they exist. Let's look at my online community life. Let's take Facebook, for instance. Okay, I have like 1,000 friends on Facebook. You look at who they are, there's a bunch of people I went to high school with, some of which I barely know. Class of 89, close enough. Okay, yeah, I'll take you. And then, but there's also, I'd say a good half of my friends are people who went to Thomas Aquinas College. And we share not only this common experience, we've all read the same 111, 112 books or whatever. We have a common experience. Now, some of those people I don't know, but this digital media has allowed these people who have had this real world experience around a table face to face to extend to other people. And so now I go online and there's cat videos and stupid crap to distract you. And I'm staying away from all that during Lent. It's good. But there's my professor, David Quackenbush, posting his daily little Lenten readings from Ratzinger. And I'm just like, oh, God, it's like he found the best quote. Yes. And I'm like, it's stuff that's like feeding me. And I'm like, an article is being posted by all. I mean, it's a filter. My community of like-minded kind of interested people are a filter. They find things that I don't have time to go look for. And I find things and we share it together. And it's interesting because there's been two or three people that didn't go to that school that are not in that community, but got enough of us as friends that other people started friending them. And now I've gotten to be really close friends online in the sense of like we share things all the time. We're constantly commenting on the same stuff. We have a lot in common. And if we ever met, we would pick up right where we left off and have a beer, even though I've never seen the man's face. I think that's actual community.
Okay, so I'll give another example that will support, I think, something you're saying, but nonetheless, I have reservations or even doubts. At Catholic Answers, Catholic.com is the second most visited website in the Catholic world, and the reason behind the Vatican. That's okay with us. But we're catching
that's
up.
That's big of you.
We're catching up. The reason it is because of the Catholic Answers forums,
right.
Which I don't know what they have, 800,000 members or something like that. And we actually have testimony, and there is a lot of just wasted time on those forums. And I don't think I'm betraying my employer by saying that.
What's the nature of the meeting?
Yeah, right, precisely. Yeah, right, yeah. But we have a lot of testimony from people who were not in the church but now are – or had this question that they couldn't get answered, or even were undergoing some kind of a spiritual crisis, and they found what they were looking for on those forums. Now, at the same time, you go to portions of them, and it's a lot of wives complaining about their husbands, how rotten they are, and all that sort of stuff. But I do think that the medium can provide something like that. But what worries me, what concerns me is the idea, perhaps, and I'm not proposing you suggested that, the idea perhaps so that can replace, for example, what we're doing right here around this table.
No, I mean, and that goes without saying, my entire life and my entire apostolate is built around putting physical locations that people come to and see the same people every day and have a cup of coffee, eat something, maybe check their email, but I'm trying to put that third place back in society.
Right.
So, I mean, no, I mean, it's definitely, I see it as something that augments, it keeps me connected to people that I care about that are physically distant from me in a way that I just don't have the time and effort to keep up with. If I literally printed out and mailed or sent an email to everybody that I'd like to share this article with when I find a great article on, you know, Ratzinger's take on the council or whatever, you know, it would take all my time.
Okay, you wouldn't do that.
I wouldn't do that.
So I was having lunch with your esteemed president today, Tim Gray, right. And he mentions to me a line in Seneca where Seneca is complaining about the advancements in the Roman postal system, right. And as a consequence of it, he's got all this mail that he has to answer. Well, of course, we laugh about that now because all of us have to go through 300 emails a day,
right.
And Seneca, I don't know, maybe has a couple of letters or whatever it is a week, or who knows. Well, he was Seneca; he probably got a lot of mail. But there's a kind of a question of scale. And I think we've gone way past it. Because when you said to me you have 1,000 friends, you and I both know those really aren't friends.
No, that's the
Facebook word for them.
Right. Yeah. I have 1,000 connections.
Right.
And or you know, I have 890 or something, in case someone wants to go check my Facebook page and call me on it, around that. But within that 1,000 people, I'd say there's a couple hundred that are actual friends or close acquaintances of mine that I really care about. And I don't want to see your cat video, but I like seeing the picture of the new baby that was born or the kids at the beach. Or I scroll through that and go, oh, that's nice. Because I don't have my own kids. It's nice to see family going on. It's nice to see my family spread out all over the country, cousins I've never met and stuff. I see that. It is what it is.
Isn't there a risk with Facebook and other things like it of a kind of commodification of friendship, a kind of a reductionism where friendship is turned into a transaction rather than a real relationship with meat and bones?
I mean, it can be, but I guess maybe I'm kind of immune to this because I'm the kind of person that has to have a few very close friends that I go deep with, or I start feeling it. And so I purposely surround myself with people that I can kind of go deep with and bare my soul and talk to. And so I don't really see it as I don't see them as the same thing. But ironically, I have a fairly deep level of exchange on occasion with people that I don't really know that well because we know enough of the same people and we have
read enough of the same stuff. Maybe you're not the best test case, right?
You know, I've got this dialed in a little bit.
Right, who talk using the acronyms that they text with.
OMG.
Right? That's bizarre. WTF. I mean, to say nothing about the sort of butchering of the English language, what does that mean in terms of friendship? Isn't there something wrong about that? Or has balance. Isn't there something disordered about that?
I believe, of course, that there is. One of the things that interests me is the things that get lost in the creation of a new technology. Sure. So, for example, the three of us are sitting here at this table, and we all have pads and pens in front of us. My handwriting is not particularly good. In fact, it stinks. My father learned calligraphy in eighth grade or whatever,
right.
And he has beautiful handwriting. Now he doesn't always do calligraphy, but when he writes, he writes and he has nice stationery and he writes good letters. And by the way, it isn't simply the appearance of it, the beauty of it, which I think is important, and I know you gentlemen agree with me, but also there's something about the nature of composing with a pen and versus what we refer to as word processing. And in fact, I think word processing is actually a very good word for it because it's kind of fits and starts. I know in my own experience anyway, I'm almost to the point where I don't even think when I'm writing in complete sentences anymore because I'm revising as I'm writing. And yet when you have to sit down with a pen, you've got to kind of get it together at least a paragraph at a time.
Right, right.
And so there's something cognitive that's lost in that and beautiful that's lost in
that. I'm with you on that. I think
I wanted to say something about the right brain, left brain thing on this, right? Because I think typing is a very left brain style activity.
Right.
But writing with the pen, especially writing calligraphy, is like drawing. Right. So to me it seems like you're drawing on both sides of your brain, right and left,
right.
when you're writing with a pen versus just
And I have different, not only even writing, for little notes and stuff and day-to-day use, you'll see me with a yellow legal pad, G2 Pilot with the hacked Mont Blanc rollerball refill in it. That's what I use, right?
I didn't know you could hack a Mont Blanc.
You can. I'll tell you. We'll end the podcast.
Yeah, there's a podcast about
that. Is there a YouTube video?
There is. God bless the digital media. I will share I will share. This has changed my life. I will share the Mont Blanc hack with everybody. But then you got your Moleskine in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's like I use that primarily for journaling.
Yeah.
So it's if I have this piece of paper in the same pen versus if I have my version of that in front of me, it elicits a different mode, to speak. And it's funny, I think I might have told you this story before. I met through a friend of mine, Nick Blaha, who's now Father Nick Blaha, who was a Focus missionary.
Sure.
And he came and went to TAC and visited, and he'd alumni, hey, come to Focus, and we chatted, and I told him about this coffee thing I wanted to start. So he goes back and he mentions it to his team. A girl on his team says, hey, I've always wanted to do that too. So she emails me. So we start emailing back and forth, and then she kind of goes silent. And then a couple months later, I get a longhand written letter in an envelope with a stamp and everything from my former email pen pal about these ideas. And it turns out she had entered a convent. Or not a convent per se. She joined the community of St. John.
But they don't do email.
Right. They don't do. She was in her novitiate year. So we started writing back and forth longhand. And I noticed that my correspondence with her took on this very contemplative, kind of quasi-poetic form, because the only time I ever wrote longhand anymore in any way, real way, was when I was journaling. Mm. And so then that kind of stopped. One day, the phone rings and she says, hey, this is Natalie. I'm not in the convent anymore. Uh-huh. And we started talking on the phone. Right. So this one, and I noticed that
it's like three different phases.
Yeah, three different phases. And I noticed that the communication was different in each phase because of the medium. I mean, this is Malcolm McLaren, right? The medium is the message, right? And that goes, he's a Catholic, right? I think that there are, if you understand that and you're self-aware enough to know that, then you can kind of hack yourself and do that. If I need to get ideas out and I don't want to compose yet, I pull this out and start writing, because I'm just going to like do bullet points.
Right.
And if I want to compose, if I'm composing a paper or something, I'm going to get the word processor in front of me, because I can kind of make myself think or write in the way I want to write by which tool that I have in front of me. And so I think options are good. My favorite thing to start doing now is I'm in the car and slightly moving, kind of like traffic patterns, is one of the few places in your natural life where it does a psychological thing to you and puts your right brain going. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you have so many creative ideas. Driving, the shower is another one.
Right.
So I will turn my phone on, open up my my record button, and I will sit and dictate an idea to myself. Yeah. And they've got software where you can turn that into text, and it's pretty decent recognition, and you can email it to yourself, cut it, and paste it. So, I mean, these tools, if you use them as tools, they're great tools. They're bad.
And not as slaves.
They're, yeah, if, yeah. Yeah, to use the tool, don't be the tool.
Yeah, okay, right. Yeah, so this will bring everything full circle. You mentioned the term e-slavery before. Maybe you could just explain that to us.
Well, I think we've sort of touched on this anyway. It's this condition where we are so attached to our devices and our technologies that we can't put them down. I mean, you both have heard, I'm sure, I don't know the details on this, but teenagers exchanging thousands of texts over the space of a month.
Sure.
And some of, and now, in fact, apparently there's some psychological effect that goes on where these kids are sleeping with the iPhones or whatever. And if they don't get, you know, text periodically, they start to go through kind of a withdrawal.
Wow.
Yeah, as a consequence. So, so it's a dependency, and I think that setting that stuff aside on Sundays or Wednesdays and Fridays or whatever it is, I think Sunday makes a lot of sense, like Tim was saying, because it helps keep the Sabbath. But it's that dependency.
Sure.
On these devices.
I so look forward to Saturday mornings, because if I'm not so much on Wednesdays and Thursdays because I open the cafe, but on the other days, Saturday and Sunday is the only day that I can just turn my text trigger off and turn my entire phone off, because I don't know, one out of 30 days they come in and there's something, the POS won't load up or something.
Right.
They need the manager to do something, so I have to be available. But then, you know, Chris Stefanik, if you're listening, Chris will text me, because he's in another time zone, and he'll text me, and it's 7:30 in the morning on my day off, and I'm like, I'm single. It's 7:30. I'm asleep. I'm going to noon mass, and it's like, I'm like, oh, come on, you know. So, but I have to leave it on. But Saturdays, I turn the phone off, no alarm, no nothing, and no one can wake me up with a text.
Right. Well, and this is one of the problems with modern technology is interruption, right? Is that you're almost like not allowed to concentrate on anything for 30 minutes or an hour or 2 hours, because you're expected by the culture to be constantly available all the time on your cell phone, by email, whatever.
Well, I send you an email 5 minutes ago.
Yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, or that horrible phrase, did you read my email? Oh, yeah. I hate that, because it's like, shoot, when did they send it? You know, you have to be constantly available.
You and I have both read The 4-Hour Work Week.
Yeah.
Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a certain way in which you can kind of
cheat the system.
You can sculpt that.
It's true.
You can sculpt people's expectations of
you. Right.
And if you consistently tell them on the, I'm tempted to put onto my byline, look, I check email twice a day,
sure,
and I don't check it on Sundays or whatever.
Right.
So,
and I don't respond right away.
Sometimes if I'm in the middle of something, you may get an email back from me tomorrow afternoon.
Right.
You know, most of my friends know that if you need me ASAP, I usually have my text ringer on.
Yeah.
And they'll text me.
But
I'll shut that off.
I guess what I'm saying is that it used to be you could go outside and take a walk and not have a phone ring while you're taking a walk, right?
Sure.
Or you could
you're right.
You could go into your office and close the door and concentrate on something for 2 or 3 hours without any interruptions.
Now, you can still do that, though.
It's true, right? But
I
feel like
it's got an off switch.
What I'm saying is, I think it takes more effort.
It does take a lot of effort,
especially interpersonally, to make those things happen, to carve out that time, etc.
You know, we really need to. Someone needs to create something between off and on, where my phone is. I mean, I guess I could just change.
You could put on vibrate.
No, I know, in the sense of like, I mean, I want to put, you call my phone.
Oh, and it delivers everything at a given time.
And I just say, and you don't get a chance to leave voicemail or anything. You just get a recording saying, I'm reading, it's Monday morning, I read Plato on Monday mornings. I'm reading the Joe Sachs translation of The Republic at a coffee house. I just got a phone call right now from someone from Northern Los Angeles County. So that's either an alumni or a bill collector.
I think there's a story about Evelyn Waugh not wanting a telephone in his, installed in his home.
Sure. Well, or there's this Franciscan monastery out east that They got a phone, but it was ringing off the hook all the time. So they just got rid of it. They're just like, why bother? You know, we need to pray. So they got rid of their phone. People can write letters.
That happened on Downton Abbey when they put the phone in. They were like, oh, this blasted thing's going to be ringing all the time.
I think I'm the one person in the universe who's not caught up on Downton Abbey.
I'm not on this. I haven't caught up this season.
I haven't watched an episode.
Oh, okay. I tried to watch the first one.
Yeah. I have to admit, I do enjoy it. You know, you brought up one thing though. You brought up Evil Wah. My favorite Evelyn Waugh story is whenever he's walking out of some pipe shop on Fleet Street or whatever, and some woman like stops him and says, you know, I can't believe that you treat people the way you do. Like in the Times, he would just excoriate people's books and stuff. It's like, I can't believe that you act like this and call yourself a Catholic.
Right.
And he says, ma'am, I only ask that you would consider what I would be like were it not for my
right, right, sure. I've heard the same story. He was berating the waiters or something like that.
Yeah, I'm just like, that is my testimony. Yes. I am half the jerk I used to be.
Yeah, sure. You know? Sure.
Okay, the Mont Blanc hack?
Oh, yeah, because this will be the very last
Mont Blanc hack
moment here.
Okay. Text message. Mont Blanc
is... You take a G2 pen like this.
Yeah. So G2 pen.
Right.
Okay, I get the G2 Limited, which is that same pen, except costs a little more, and it's got a metal sheath and a little rubber thing. It's fatter.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, this is a G2 Pilot.
Okay.
A G2 Limited.
Yeah.
But it'll work in this, the little G2 pens.
Okay.
Right? And he's got one too, right?
Sure.
So what you do is you go buy... the Mont Blanc rollerball refills.
Right.
And how much does that cost?
$12 for two.
Okay.
And there's a little piece of plastic on the end. It's got a little line around it. Mm-hmm. And it's one's kind of slightly smaller than the other. And you just use a knife, or I use the end of my wine key. You can use your fingernail clippers, whatever. And you just clip that little piece of plastic off the end. And the Mont Blanc rollerball refill fits the G2, wild. Exactly.
And they're that much better than the G2 refills?
I mean, it's night and day.
Okay.
This is like a...
I had a Mont Blanc pen, something my wife gave me many, many years ago, and I don't even... I used to like to carry it around and sort of wave it when I was making an important point or something like that. Now when I see somebody waving a Mont Blanc, I think I'm a jackass.
Right.
But anyway...
It just writes like butter. I mean, sometimes they don't last as long as I would like.
Yeah, that was my experience. It ran out, but they do write nice.
But this is $10 for the pen, $6 for the refill.
And
it's a $300 pen. I mean, that's a $300 pen.
Do the Mont Blanc refills come in different widths? I mean, in points or whatever.
One of the things I
like about the G2 is I like the thicker one. The point five.
This seems to be about like the thicker. Try this one.
Yeah.
This is about the thickness. So it makes It makes me want to write.
Oh yeah, that does feel nice.
It's just butter. It's just really clean. I like the blue.
Why? What do you write? Yeah. Come on.
I just like the nice. There's a lot of possibility.
In the Marine Corps, we learned black ink, and that's
stuck, huh?
Yeah, you can't get away from it.
Blue's the Air Force color. All right. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of our show.
I think we solved a lot of the world's problems, though.
Yeah, we did, and. It sounds like, you know, we could do another episode at some point.
The Mont Blanc hack was worth the price of admission.
I think so.
Yeah. So you've learned a lot today about the Civil War, the war between the states, e-slavery.
We're going to get emails about the slavery
and about pens as well. So I just want to thank you so much, Christopher, for being with us.
Oh boy, what a joy to be with you and to be here at the Augustine Institute. What a magnificent place this is.
Yeah, and we're just so happy to have you with us, and I really look forward
our
to your lecture tonight.
You're the first guest
on our podcast, so. I'm sure we'll get millions of listeners now.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
We've proven that we can bring a guest that it's still not turned into the slavish Catholic media that asks you what you're here to promote, you know.
All right. So
like on EWTN.
Oh my goodness!
I just love to watch you cringe when I. I just love watching you cringe when I.
I'll have to edit that up. Anyway,
there's a lot of great stuff on EWT.
So
I just like watching you cringe.
I know that our whole audience is in tears, but we have finally reached the end of episode 6 of the Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Eastcheck,
and I'm Andrew Rayleigh.